Monday morning, yeah, in the bunker right here in North Central Indiana, and this is Terrible Tommy, and that was, guess who, the King, Elvis Presley. That was by special request to one of our friends out there that sent in. I like jailhouse rock. In fact, when I was in the Army back in the 50s, I went on leave, and I was over in London when jailhouse rock premiered at one of the big theaters downtown London. So Tommy got in a line about a half a mile long and went to see Jailhouse Rock, first time it had played in England. So anyhow, it's a fun movie and like that. But the song, you know, we'll dedicate that to our poor old buddy Dick Craig Cobb up there in 50 below 0 degrees in Leith, North Dakota. Yeah, that might warm him up a little if he could dance to that song. P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. That's where you send your snail mail and your donations for the radio show. And thank you. A lot of you guys have got yours in already for the month of January. We appreciate that. And the extras also that we can send along to the prisoners. I got a letter the other day from Craig Cobb. Said that I was the only one who'd sent him any correspondence, any letters. I was really shocked at that, that more people at least would have sent him a postcard or something. So anyhow, now I know what I've said and how they screwed up and how his buddy screwed up and all that kind of stuff, but to totally let them totally hang out to dry, I think, is a mistake, because our opposition used that to dissuade new people and other people from dealing with this, for saying that we abandoned people and so forth like that. So I don't think that I have to be misinterpreted that I disagree with the tactics. But I've been in jail. I know how it is to be in jail, even though I wasn't in jail for a long, long time. It was long enough to know that it's not a damn good feeling to be penned up and not be getting any communication from the outside. However, I did have telephone contact and some mail come to the jail. So anyhow, I'm doing it, and I know some of you guys are going to be critical of that, but I'm afraid I'm going to have to go to the woodshed, because it's just not Tommy's nature to totally ignore people who have, even though mistakenly, have done things that have not been beneficial, but who are caught by the system. And I kind of put my hatred of the system a lot worse than disliking what some of our friends have done. I communicate with a lot of prisoners and send them information and so forth. I don't have time to sit down and analyze every case and why they're in there. So it's the same with this situation. I don't have time to do it, and I think it's somebody's down in the dungeon, and they ask for a little information or help. I think we got to give it to them, almost no matter what. Anyhow, you can write a note to Craig Cobb or Keenan Dutton. Now, you address either one to the Mercer County Jail, P.O. Box 39, Stanton, North Dakota, 58571. And the other fellow's name was Keenan, K-Y-N-A-N, Dutton, same address. Now you can send your mail right on into them. It's sort of a laid back jail, and I think it's a little bit like Barney Fife's jail. But anyhow, they said you can send cash in too, so might want to send them a few bucks. I advised Craig in a letter that we got to forget about this oil field situation, because the environmental destruction that's happening in southern Canada and in North Dakota, and the planned bad situation we have with this big sandy pipeline that's being built all the way down to the Gulf of Mexico, to the cracking plants down there, and that gasoline that's being going to be taken care of down there is not going to help U.S. drivers anyhow. That's going out to ports around the world, and probably most of it's going to China. In the meantime, we've got this giant pipeline they're building down across the country, and there's obviously going to be leaks and problems, because we've seen that in the news already. There's been leaks in these pipelines and caused a lot of problems. We had one up here in northern Indiana where a million gallons of oil into the creeks and rivers up there, and that's terrible. And so I told Craig, I said, I don't want to encourage guys to go up there and work in those oil fields anymore, because it's sort of being a hypocrite, because I am totally against this oil company and the things they do and the things they cause. Now look, we had a couple of tanker cars explode up there in North Dakota, and that's extremely bad for the ecology, and if it happens near inside the city limits, it's going to kill a lot of people. They've already had one up in Canada that went up. I don't know how many cars of these oil, because that's how they have to get it out now, that went up and burned about 50, 60 people alive, as I recall. So I don't want to encourage our participation in this oil field. You know, it seems like a good idea where guys can make quite a bit of money fast, but the downside of it is not good at all for white environment. Now, right-wingers, they say, oh, well, jobs, jobs, jobs. Well, there's something more important than just a high-paying job, and that's the air we breathe and the water we drink and like that. So we got to remember that when we're making these kind of decisions. Well, since they laughingly accused Craig Cobb of being 16% Negro, I told him, and I don't think I told you guys this, I said, look, if you're 16% Negro, then I want you to get in touch with that talk show gal you did the show with and say, look, we want you to get with the NAACP and send some attorneys out here to North Dakota to defend these guys, or defend Craig, the 16% Negro. I mean, come on. NAACP should step in and defend him in this case. I had a guy call me last night on a telephone from out west, and he said, is it true, the rumor is, that you advised Craig Cobb to contact the NAACP to take his case? I said, sure is. The best way to fight fire is with fire, baby. I don't think I gave you the zip code on that Mercer County Jail, P.O. Box 39, Stanton, North Dakota, 58571. Even send them postcards. You know, postcards are pretty cool because then the jailer gets to read them too. So don't put anything illegal on there or threatening. But let's get these guys some mail, and they understand that we don't agree with the way what they did and how they did it. So let's get that behind us. Well, I was reading from the internet this morning some outfit that's critical of the IHR people, Institute for Hysterical Review, and I forget the name of the guy that was interviewing Mark Weber. I didn't read it all, but came up with my name in it, so I tuned in to see what the hell they were talking about. So they referred to me about 45 minutes into the show. Ernst Zundel is not in prison. He's in jail. Prisons are where convicted prisoners go. Jail is where people go during the trial. Mr. Weber quickly glides over the fact that Zundel spent a year in detention in Canada, but he doesn't mention why. Well, it's obviously a free speech issue. This was way back before Zundel was taken to Germany. Zundel was held because the government of Canada wanted to determine whether he was a threat to the national security. What a joke. Those bastards. Concluding that he was, and of course, I don't ever remember reading the evidence of how he was a threat to Canada's national security. The government in Ottawa is the threat to Canada's national security, not poor old Ernst. Concluding that he was, they deported him to Germany. Well, they did not. He came down to the United States because he had a lady friend that he was hooking up with down in Pigeon Forge, Tennessee, I believe it is. Down there, all you old guys may remember, Tom Anderson used to operate out of Pigeon Forge. And among the reasons that Zundel was deported from Canada was his relationship with Tom Metzger, the leader of the White Aryan Resistance, a neo-Nazi group operating out of Southern California. Well, that wasn't the reason at all. I had worked somewhat with Zundel, not much, but some, and I'd been on his radio show or TV show up in Canada, and he'd been on my TV show down here, and so anyhow, he decided he was going to come down here to the United States, and I warned him, hey, it's a trap. You better not come down here. But as usual, and he didn't listen to me. So he comes down here to see his Ingrid, his sweetie pie, and next few days, I guess, after he got there, here come the federales and picked him up and shipped him back to Germany, which had nothing to do with any relationship with Tom Metzger, because that relationship was not that great big a deal. Metzger has been to jail more than once and lost several million dollars in civil rights suits for inciting to murder. Well, that's totally a lie, too. There was nothing in the trial about inciting to murder in the case. It was simply, if it had been, it would have been a criminal charge. It was a civil charge. In the case of killing Ethiopian exchange student in Portland, Oregon, you know, the longer this case hangs around over the years, the more they add to it and distort it and add more lies to it. They said, I'd say such associations, indeed friendships, are reason for concern on the part of the Canadian government. No country should be forced to accept immigrants that it believes may compromise their safety. Ha ha ha, we got 20 million, 30 million here that we think may be compromising our safety. That's ridiculous. Ernst Zundel being a threat to the nation of Canada was such a out and right bald-faced kike joke that it's enough to gag a maggot. So anyhow, there they go. Of course, I don't have too much use for Institute for Historical Review, because I think that it may have caused more problems than it's worth. So, up in the 50s, I never heard of anything like all this mass killing of Jews, and I don't think there was too much of that around. And then all of a sudden we get the IHR started up with Willis Carteau, and they start putting stuff out, and all of a sudden the big boys from the Jews came stomping in, Spielberg making these giant big movies and everything, and this whole business of the Holocaust started from there. And I think if the Institute for Historical Review had not been created, and people hadn't come out leading with their chin like several of the so-called experts on this stuff did, it would never have grown to what it is. So the Jews, as far as I'm concerned, the Jews have to give great thanks to the people who created this anti-Holocaust thing. I guess you'd have to lay a lot of it at the feet of Willis Carteau himself. And then they sued. They offered $50,000 to any Jew anybody could prove the Holocaust. Well, you don't think that they're going to disprove the Holocaust in any courtroom in this country or any country outside maybe the third world. So for them to be so dumb, Willis Carteau, and even my, well, anyhow, I won't go into that, to be that dumb to think you could go in and offer $50,000 and they end up having to cough up $50,000, thinking they'd get a fair shake in any court in this country, the fix wasn't in, jeez, that's terrible. No, I think probably the best way to have confronted the so-called Holocaust thing was just silence. Be quiet. It wouldn't be near as big an industry as it's become. And we still got everybody going back and forth about it. And why don't people just say, like I've said for years, there was a hell of a lot of Jews died at the direct results of the instructions in Germany. But that is nothing to do with 6 million, and leave it at that. Instead of saying, "Oh, none of it ever happened," and I've heard, young skinheads saying, "Oh, there was no mass killing of Jews or large numbers." Well, that's nonsense. There were, if not on the Western Front, the Eastern Front, and the Russians even got into the act. So why don't we just say, yeah, there's a hell of a lot of Jews were killed, and it was a part of the war situation. And if you don't like lots of people dying. Well, don't have wars. I mean, there were plenty of Jews profiting from the First World War. In fact, the First World War led directly to the Second World War. So you could, the big shot Jews and the Jew bankers and the Rothschilds and all of them were involved in financing the First World War. Well, didn't that lead directly into Hitler coming to power? The rape of Germany after the war and all that. So, in essence, you could say that a lot of big-shot Jews and Jew bankers and Rothschilds started something that ended up with the killing of hundreds of thousands of Jews. I won't go so far as to say, I'll go so far as to say I probably hundreds, a few hundred thousand Jews, maybe. Or I think the Red Cross said something years ago, maybe a couple of hundred thousand. Well, it was Second World War was a tremendous tragedy, the greatest tragedy that the white race has ever faced. 55 million people died in the Second World War, so let's leave it at that. We don't need to be building these damn arcades around with all kinds of... The only thing good about these Jew arcades and circuses they build around is National Socialists can go in there and see a lot of the good things that they've saved from the war. Souvenirs and stuff like that. So, but anyhow, it's ridiculous. And most of these revisionists are not racial. Or at least they're not racial activists. Most of them, they'll argue to health reasons over about how many Jews can dance on the head of a pin. But they don't cry about what's happening to the white race, not only in the United States, but Europe. Or they give 10% of their time to that problem and 90% of the time to, we're going to clean up the image of National Socialist Germany and we're going to get people to think Hitler was a real good guy. It's never going to happen. It's never going to happen. Well, I forgot to say this was January the 6th. 2014. Everybody keeps telling me, Tom, put 14 on there. You keep putting 13 on there. I usually do that every year for the first couple of weeks. Put the wrong year date on my stuff. Well, I'm telling you, we got snow here like you wouldn't believe. We got 6-foot drifts across the road. Luckily, my neighbor's a good neighbor. He came over with his big tractor this morning real early and scraped out my parking lot, so we're sitting fine here, but there was so much snow in front of the front door, I couldn't get out the front door this morning, so anyhow, I had to do a little shoveling, and I tell you, that windshield factor is murder. You can't stay out in it very long. Well, let's talk a little bit about labor this morning. This is from one of our supporters. Isn't it ironic how the person posting this blames Obama again, and yet Wisconsin is the state of union buster, right-to-work cheap Governor Scott Walker, Republican, and both the state legislatures are Republican-dominated, state Senate 18 Republicans, 15 Democrats, and the state Assembly 60 Republicans and 39 Democrats. Republicans swept into power in that state, severely weakening labor laws, claiming that it would make the state a mecca for jobs and industry. And yet the result is big companies are still fleeing with their jobs and wages and benefits in the state and have plummeted for workers. Benefits have plummeted for workers. The bottom line is that predatory capitalists will always flee to the cheapest labor source. Unless you're willing to reduce American wages below those in China or some other third world cesspool, they will continue to flee. It's not an Obama thing. It's a capitalism thing. For Christ's sake, people, get your minds right. Well, the right wingers have trouble with that, Mr. Contributor. They're fixated on Obama. And, of course, most of the guys are afraid to say anything because they're afraid of being, oh, you're a nigger lover, man. You're a nigger lover. Well, Look, we've had rotten, corrupt presidents for as far back as I can remember, and warmongers and war criminals and everything else. Obama's no better, no worse than the rest of them. And do I feel happy that we have a mixed-breed mulatto president? No, but you can't accuse him of everything that's happening. He's not wrong about everything, and I think that's something that white racists have to understand. We got to tell the truth as much as we can get the evidence of what truth is. And when a company picks up and moves to China, it's primarily because the National Chamber of Commerce promotes it, but the Republican-dominated Congress goes along with it big time. And so let's face it, we need to raise tariffs and punish these corporations and hope that they have a miserable time over there in China, hope they get burnt out, hope that partisans in these third world countries burn out these corporate factories over there. You know, try to give them a little warning so the poor workers can get out, and then burn them to the ground. Then when the corporations beg to come back to the United States, well, say, it's going to cost you, and we're not going to give you any free rides, and we're not going to cut your taxes, and you're going to be, and if you stay over there, we're going to raise tariffs to the point where you're screwed. That's my story, and I'm sticking to it. And that last message, it was referring to General Electric. They're planning to move its 115-year-old X-ray division from Waukesha, Wisconsin, to Beijing. And remember also, there's a bunch of warmonger plants up there. The one that makes those, I forget what they call them, these little bombs that they throw all over the place and kids pick them up, blow their hands and arms off and things like that. You know, they got one of those big plants up there in Wisconsin. In addition to moving the headquarters, the company will invest $2 billion in China and educate more than 65 Chinese engineers and create 6 research centers. This is the same GE that made $5.1 billion in the United States last year, but paid no taxes. Read my lips. No taxes. The same company that employs more people overseas than it does in the United States. So let me get this straight. President Obama appointed GE Chairman Jeff Immelt to head his commission on job creation, JobSAR. Immelt is supposed to be creating jobs. Yeah. Let's see here. I guess the president forgot to tell him in which country he was supposed to create those jobs in. Yeah, but he's just like the rest of the presidents. I mean, they don't give a shit about the workers, except if it's bad press when they don't do something for the workers, but all they do is bullshit about the workers. Just remember, once by the time you get to Congress, you're already at least a millionaire, and most are multimillionaires, and when they come out, they're multimillionaires. And, of course, that Lebanese piece of crap out there in California, the Republican, whose name escapes me right at the moment, he was my congressman out there, he's the richest man in Congress, with hundreds of millions of dollars in his coffers, and he is an incomer from Lebanon. Yeah, Lebanon, and he had a bad record too, car thievery and so forth. So what, man? It's all right. Come on in and take it. Anyhow, these guys don't become multimillionaires in Congress with the donations from working class people. They're getting it from the ruling class and the wealthy. So you know which side their bread is buttered on, and that's the way they go. And until you serfs get that through your head, nothing's going to change. And even then, nothing's going to change unless you take it to the streets get out the pitchforks, the knives, the hacksaws, or whatever it takes. I'm not kidding. That's the only thing that'll change it. Well, here's a comment from one of our friends. TT, just want to comment on the Boeing situation. Those union members had good reason to fear what would happen if they didn't agree to Boeing's terms. Several years back, when they were faced with a similar situation involving the 787, they did not accept the terms, and Boeing did in fact build a new facility in Charleston, South Carolina, and move thousands of jobs there. South Carolina is a right-to-work cheap state. Now manufacture of the 787 is shared between South Carolina, which gives huge tax breaks to the company, Italy, and Japan. The union members in Washington paid a huge price for not agreeing to Boeing's terms in the past. It's basically a form of extortion. Well, it is extortion. Either you agree to their terms or everyone loses their jobs and the company just moves to a different, more capitalistic friendly state. Well, I understand all that, but that's the problem. I realize what you are saying, but this is leading to a complete capitulation of the U.S. labor movement. Well, I guess worse is still better, since the white working class still don't get it. Yeah, okay. Well, here was an addendum to that. I wasn't agreeing with the union surrender, only stating their reasons for doing it. Well, I think we all pretty well understand that. Ultimately, unions are going to either return to the violence of the early 20th century that made them what they were, or they will eventually all simply utterly collapse into a feudalistic state. Those are my terms. You can't adequately fight the predatory capitalist monster with union votes and picket signs. Well, you can't fight them on any level with that, because they control the money, and you can't do that. It's got to come, as Jefferson said, the bloodletting at some point. Every 20 years, how about that? But it's sad to say that I think that it may take another generation to get this thing going. I think that the remnants of all the good life people out there may have to suffer greatly for part of a generation, or maybe a full generation, before, as serfs, they decide there's no other way out. They should know it now, but they don't. And they're trying to go along to get along, and that never works in the long run. Well, let's see here. How about China being behind the nuclear program of Iran and every other rogue state, according to this? Interesting, huh? Let's look into this one a little bit. In November, immediately after the announcement that Iran had reached a deal with the Western negotiators concerning its nuclear program, China's former ambassador to Tehran, Hu Liming, made the case that Beijing, not the American Secretary of State John Kerry, or the European Union envoy Catherine Ashton, ultimately deserved credit for brokering the agreement. Quote, when the two parties came across irresolvable problems, they would come to China, which would lubricate the negotiations to put things back on track, unquote. Who, apparently speaking at the direction of the Communist Party, told Chinese state media. Isn't that sweet? There's been considerable disagreement about whether the interim arrangement, which partially freezes Iran's nuclear program, is a good deal for the international community. Beijing's enthusiasm is sufficient evidence that it's not. China is Iran's best big power friend, and if Hao is to be believed, then Beijing thinks it has just scored a triumph for its friends in Tehran. This is the latest instance of the Chinese, mostly in concert with the Russians and sometimes alone, providing diplomatic support where it counts, without China running interference with the Board of Governors of the International Atomic Energy Agency and the UN Security Council, the Russians would undoubtedly be less willing to support Tehran. But with Beijing in the background and sometimes out front, the Iranians can hold off others as their nuclear efforts proceed at what appears to be rapid pace. So you see how the United States' attitude towards Iran over all these years and overthrowing their democratically appointed president has caused them to become more hateful of the United States and pushed them right into the arms of the Red Chinese. So anyhow, there you go. Well, let's get on to Tommy's Wayback Machine here and see what's going on over there in France. Paris. It is difficult to go more than a day in France without hearing someone express the conviction that the greatest problem in the country is its racial minorities. That the presence of immigrants or invaders compromises the identity of France itself. This conviction is typically expressed without any acknowledgement of the country's historical responsibility as the colonial power for the presence of former colonial non-whites in the metropolitan France, nor with any willingness to recognize that France will be racially diverse from here on out, and that it's the responsibility of the French as much as of the immigrants, invaders, to make this work. Well, in the past year, I have witnessed incessant stop and frisk of young black men in Gare du Nord, in contrast with New York. Here in Paris, this practice is scarcely debated at all. Well, that's a good thing. I was told by a taxi driver as we passed through a black, Negro, nigger neighborhood, quote, "I hope you got your shots. You don't need to go to Africa anymore to get a tropical disease," unquote. On numerous occasions, French strangers have offered up the observation to me in reference to racial minorities going about their lives in the capital. Quote, "There's no longer France. France is over," unquote. There is a constant droning presupposition in virtually all social interactions that a clear and meaningful division can be made between the people who make up the real France and the imposters. I arrived here in 2012, an American recently teaching in a Canadian university to take a position at the French University in Paris. I had long been a moderately interested observer of French history, culture, and politics, but had never lived here for any length of time and had on previous stays never grown attuned to the deep rifts that mark so much of their daily lives. Wow. When I'm addressed by strangers anxious about the fate of their country, I try to reply patiently, as a liberal really does, you know. They hear my American accent, but this in itself does not dissuade them, for I belong to a different category of foreigner. I'm not read as an immigrant, but rather as an expatriate, here for voluntary and probably frivolous reasons, rather than an out of economic necessity of fear for my own survival or freedom. This division is not just a street-level prejudice. It is also written in the procedure at the French immigration offices, where all foreigners must go to obtain their residence permits, but where the Malians and the Congolese are taken into one room and the Americans and the Swedes into another. For the former, the procedure has an air of quarantine, and to the attitude of the officials is somewhat resembling that of a prison guard. For the latter, the visit to the immigration office feels rather more like a welcoming ceremony, and everything about our interaction with the officials bespeaks a presumption of equality. I noticed here in this article, too, that it said up here, it says, when equality is invoked, it is understood that this is equality among equals. That's an interesting comment. I like that. Equality among equals. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, that's all there is to that. We'll see. Where in the hell is my... Oh, there it is.
Spoke today about an exclusive interview he conducted with another member of SEAL Team 6, the group that, as we all know by now, conducted the raid that killed the terrorist leader. Let's take a look.
Peter, in addition to meeting bin Laden, you also visited the compound where he was killed. Tell us this third SEAL's account.
The third SEAL's account is actually very close to what Mark Owen told 60 Minutes. The point man saw bin Laden stick his head out of his bedroom, shot him, mortally wounded him, and then two more SEALs came in and finished him off on the floor, Mark Owen and the shooter in the Esquire article. So what the difference here is, in the shooter in the Esquire article, you know, as you said in your piece, shoots bin Laden while he's standing up. He looks like he's maybe going to go for a gun. The SEAL Team 6 member I spoke to said that's completely false.
Bergen goes on to say that the SEAL Team 6 member he spoke with said that bin Laden could not have reached for a gun because he didn't have a weapon nearby. The story conflicts with that of the so-called bin Laden shooter, who was recently profiled in Esquire magazine. Bergen did say, however, that since the raid was conducted at night and the team was all wearing night vision goggles, some confusion about the events that transpired could be understood.
Well, it's pretty obvious, boys and girls. They didn't want him to talk. That's what they do to these guys like Osama bin Laden and Saddam Hussein. They don't want these guys appearing in any court talking. If Saddam Hussein or any of these guys were brought to some place and interrogated and questioned and put on trial, it'd be hell to pay in Washington for all the collusion and money-making and all the treason and everything that goes on. So they're instructed very simply. When you see him, kill him. And then even throw the body over the side into the sea. Yeah. It's obvious. The simple answer is usually the correct answer. People who have conspired with people don't want the co-conspirators to talk. Kill them all.
As you know, ladies and gentlemen, this is perhaps the most important facet of the university curriculum. Your capacity to function in society and to contribute are of the essence. Now, Mr. Clinton, in the area of social interrelationship, a hypothetical case, look at Mr. Barnes to your right. The hypothesis follows. Mr. Barnes is in competition with you for an extremely important professional position. Now, first, I want you to describe Mr. Barnes for me.
About 5'10", approximately 155 pounds.
His age?
21.
Look at him again. Is there any other salient feature which you might consider relevant?
He's black.
And being black may pose a special problem. What sort of a special problem?
Well, he might be pushy, aggressive.
Anything else?
He might be inferior. Being black, he might possibly be inferior.
So we have Mr. Barnes here as an irritant, a possible block to your ambition. An inferior man who is trying to usurp your superiority. What would you do to a man like that, Mr. Clinton?
On the primary emotional level,
that's all I want from you now.
I'd slap him.
Quite correct. Do so if you will.
Yes, sir.
Rise if you will, Mr. Barnes. All right, Mr. Barnes, describe the gentleman who has just slapped you.
6 foot tall, 180 pounds, 21 years of age, blonde hair.
Complexion?
White.
A Caucasian?
A Caucasian.
Primary emotional level again, your reaction.
Bigoted, aggressive, preset prejudices, illogical attitudes.
And your response?
Slap him back.
Do so, if you will, Mr. Barnes. All right, gentlemen. Independently, please, a reaction to what you have just done.
Satisfaction.
Mr. Barnes.
Satisfaction.
You may be seated, gentlemen.
What you have just heard was a training class. This is a science fiction show by Rod Serling. A science fiction class in which replicas of humans, robots, were being trained to take the place of humans who had, due to one reason or another, warfare, whatever, disappeared from the face of the earth and being replaced by robots. And that was going through some of the training exercises. Now you'll hear the graduating speech to these robots at their graduation from this scientific university. So it looks like they got it right the second time around. After all the humans were gone, these were almost all white, the whole class. So these robots that were replacing previous man were all white, except I think there was one black in the class. But they've improved, and they're not going to make the same mistakes the second time. Well, I'm not sure how to take this. This allegedly took place in Canada. Yeah. A high school student grabbed a Jewish female classmate, held a lighter to her hair, and said out loud, quote, "Let's burn the Jew," unquote. But a Canadian judge concluded that the incident was not racially motivated. The incident between two 15-year-old Winnipeg, Canada high school students took place in 2011. The lawyer for the defendant claimed essentially it was the girl's fault her hair caught on fire. He said his client grabbed the girl, lit the lighter, and made the comments, but her hair caught fire when she pulled away. He was told that referring to the girl as a Jew was simply the way people interacted at the school. And the defendant was not the only one who called her that. He referred to his client as a jerk and a bully, but said the incident was impulsive and unplanned. The defendant's therapist claimed the incident was an impulsive teenage action. Winnipeg's provincial court judge Robert Fenolason, before whom the trial was held, agreed with the defense. While he called the act totally vulgar and inappropriate, Findlayson said he was satisfied it was not racially motivated. Well, no, because the Jews aren't a race. But anyhow, given the judge was unwilling to classify saying, "Let's burn the Jew," and then actually grabbing a Jew and burning her hair as anti-Semitic, perhaps he should be praised for also stating the school culture in which this kind of incident was commonplace was unhealthy and dark, and there's no place for it in society. Wow. The victim claimed the incident changed her world upside down. She needed therapy to deal with her fears. She also believes that the people in the school blamed her for making a big deal of the incident. The now 17-year-old defendant was not given any prison time. Instead, the court ordered him to serve 18 months of supervised probation. He also has to seek out counseling and write a letter of apology to the victim and perform 75 hours of community service work, according to the Winnipeg Free Press. In an early stage of the prosecutors, the defendant pleaded guilty to assault with a weapon. Wow, man, that's something else. Well, here's a report from the KKK of Israel, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, nitwit. He told Likud's Knesset caucus Monday that the protests by invading Negro African infiltrators, quote, won't help them because we're determined to deport them and all those who succeed to infiltrate and cross our borders, without referring directly to the United Nations, which has sharply criticized Israel for not accepting the infiltrators as refugees. Netanyahu said that Israel's taking care of those who truly are refugees, but in other cases, quote, we're not talking about refugees. They are illegal nigger infiltrators looking for work. With the United Nations and foreign leftists supporting their protests, thousands of Negro infiltrators took to the streets on the second consecutive day Monday to demonstrate against Israel's policy to place them in administration detention centers for a year and deporting them if they're not proven to be refugees. Well, one of their claims is that they want to return to their native countries but want their basic rights, unquote, in Israel until they feel they can go back home. They basically are claiming they are temporary refugees. Although the United Nations, as usual, is targeting Israel, senior Likud Knesset member Ofar Akhenouz, who is the deputy minister in the prime minister office, told Channel 2 in Israel that the United States and European countries also do not recognize them as refugees. Well, there you go. Hey, Netanyahu's done something good for a change. I can't believe it. Kim Aryan of the day, Prime Minister Netanyahu, nitwit from Israel. I don't think we'll go that far. Well, well, well. U.S. fracking contamination found in well water in four states. Steve Ford, a spokesman for the Marcellus Shale Coalition, the leading industry group in Pennsylvania, said in a statement that transparency and making data available to the public is critical of getting this historic opportunity right and maintaining the public's trust. When the state environmental department determined natural gas development has caused these problems, Ford said, our members, companies, work collaboratively with the homeowner and the regulators to find a speedy solution. In other words, kick the can farther down the road. Better get a handle on it real quick because this is spreading like mad and we're going to have enough water problems in this country. And we don't need more polluted water caused by fracking all over the country. I see those twin bastards, the Koch brothers, are back at it. Political network they designed to shield donors raised $400 million in 2012. And they are backing the Tea Party. And you think Tea Party is grassroots? The political network spearheaded by the conservative billionaires Charles and David Koch has expanded into a far-reaching operation of unrivaled complexity built around a maze of groups that cloaks its donors, according to an analysis of new tax returns and other documents. The filings show that the network of politically active nonprofit groups backed by the Koch brothers and fellow donors in 2012 elections financially outpaced other independent groups on the right and on its own matched the long-established National Coalition of Labor Unions that served as one of the biggest sources of support for the Democrats. There you go. The billionaires running the show. And Tea Party people don't seem to understand. Or maybe they do understand and love it. Oh, I discovered another boob here in none other than Indiana. Yeah. Mom of five takes on the gun lobby. Well, the gun lobby actually exists because there's millions of regular gun owners involved in it. Shannon Watts didn't set out to start a national movement on the day of the Newtown, Connecticut shooting in 2012. She was only looking to vent her frustration about the state of gun control in this country. With the tragedy of the Sandy Hook Elementary as the latest example, so she started a Facebook page. Within a week, the 43-year-old Zionsville, Indiana, mother of five, had hooked up through the social media with other mothers nationwide to support taking guns away from people. Today, Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America has blossomed to nearly 130,000 members and chapters in every state. See how easy it is to organize when you're dealing with stupid people? That's our problem. We've been trying to organize among intelligent people. Over in Long Island, a kidnapped Hasidic Jew landlord was found dead. Menachem Stark's body was discovered in a dumpster at a Long Island gas station. I mean, this is one of the real get-down Hasidic Jews with the big hat on and everything. Shows a picture of him here. So I guess he screwed too many tenants. The tenants finally screwed him. Well, here is an example of the Grinch. While hundreds of fast food workers went on strike in an effort to raise the federal minimum wage, one of the men with the power to do so said there's no need for a minimum wage anymore. Congressman Joe Barton told National Journal that he would rather just get rid of it altogether. I think it's outlived its usefulness, the Texas Republican said. It may have been of some value back in the Great Depression. I would vote to repeal the minimum wage altogether. Barton doesn't explain how he would help people earn a living wage, which is defined as the salary required to support yourself and your family as the sole provider. Even in his home county, the living wage is well above the federal minimum of $7.25. Wow. Oh, Mr. Capitalista, he's a capitalista man. Well, I might as well go public with this and get it out of the way. One of our contributors says, TT, just some thoughts on the announcement by Kevin Strom that he and a few others will be attempting to rebuild the National Alliance, or at least a new version of it. While I still stand against membership groups in practice, I do think there were some positive things in the announcement. First off was that Strom was going to be doing a new broadcast of the American Dissident Voices. While Strom does have negatives and baggage, and I always found him to be a little bit effeminate, I will say that he is a professional broadcaster, and when he was doing that show, it was always produced at a high level. While I don't support membership, I do think that we are in need of some professionally produced propaganda, and I think on that he can deliver. Also, judging from the pictures he posted, it appears that a top-notch recording studio is being constructed, something that has been lacking from our supporters for quite some time. And I would ask where the money's coming from. The second positive was in his announcement that they would be moving away from Christianity and back to Pierce's cosmotheism. I didn't know that he had moved into Christianity. I guess he moved in and now he's out. Well, Pierce's cosmotheism he talked about here. I never did understand what the hell he was talking about. which is really sort of a deist philosophy merged and enhanced by modern science. It's much more logically based, as Pierce was a physics professor, and much more racially based than any form of Christianity could ever be, since you cannot separate the Jewishness from Christianity in any logical and meaningful way. The third positive, as I saw it, was the new group would not be mired in the past. Well, I'm sorry, it is. And you're not going to get away from the history of the National Alliance. And would change and evolve with time. This was his exact quote. None of this is to say that the new National Alliance will be a movement mired in the past, crystallized forever by whatever William Pierce's last utterances may have been on the topic. No, the world is changing, ever evolving, and so must our strategy and tactics also evolve, which to me indicates that the old 30 to 40 Nazi stuff is out the window, and even some of Pierce's 1970 and 1990 stuff may have to go as well, and I think that is a good and positive development. Your thoughts, TT? Well, I watched them come. I've been here the whole time they were around, and I saw fights and arguments and splits and splats and redoing this and redoing that, and Pierce sort of held it together in a way. But I don't really have confidence in Strom. I mean, he's a good speaker. Of course he's a good speaker. And I'm sure he can put on a good show on Dissident Voices. But let's ask ourselves how much money was spent in the National Alliance over a 30-year period. I venture to say a hell of a lot of money. Perhaps millions of dollars were spent. And do you see an effect? Any quantitative effect on society? I don't. I don't see it. And I don't see rebuilding the wheel, reinventing the wheel. It's all out there. Everything that needs to be said has been said a million times over. I just don't see it, but I know there's a lot of people who gravitate to this because, oh my, this guy sounds so professional. He's so, this stuff is really put together well. But what is the outcome? What do we get out of it? I'm looking at the results of, 30 years of Dr. Pierce and the boys? And I don't see anything great myself. I'm sorry, boys. I'm being a old country boy and working class kind of guy. I'm a Joe Tomasi type guy. I mean, even the rough side of Rockwell. Boots have to hit the ground at some point. And possibly the spinoff of people like Robert Matthews, who joined up with National Alliance but became a little bit disenchanted, I'm sure, and so he struck out on his own. And I'm sure that Pierce didn't say, hey, Bob Matthews, going out there and do that. I don't see it. But, obviously, I don't stand in anybody's way. Anybody can do whatever they want and try whatever idea they've got. They come to me all the time with these, we're going to do this and do that. Most of the time, it's the same old stuff, reinventing the wheel. And as far as Strom putting his bad baggage into history, it's going to follow him to the grave. I mean, the charges that went up against him, I have no way of knowing whether they're true or not, but evidently where there's smoke, there's fire. So anyhow, I know you'll see probably a lot of news broadcasts about the National Alliance and all that, the new National Alliance and all that, and then they'll just add on to it what's come from the past and the garbage of the past, and Anyhow, I'm blabbing on too long here. I don't really care. Let the dead bury the dead. The key point is the empire has to continue eating its tail, and not until this crap naturally through Mother Nature and everything else slides into the abyss, there's not going to be any major happening with our people. It's just it, and there's no way you can coax it to be done. There's no way you can force it to be done. No way you can put a gun to somebody's head and get it done. So anyhow, that's timing is everything, and this is not quite the time, I guess. Of course, I hope you realize a lot of this all came out of that so-called agreement, whether it was written or not, that part of that property in West Virginia would be given to one of their main guys there upon Pierce's death. And that didn't happen, and the well for the property was on this fellow's place where he lived, and he cut off their water, and I was called about. They were going to court, and they were going to have this nasty fight in court. I don't know whatever happened to that, whether they dropped the case or what. But all this new stuff has come out of that old fight, and all the people lined up on both sides to throw crap at each other are still out there. So I don't see how you're going to build upon that foundation. Too many hard feelings. And I think people are being a little too tough on Glebe myself. I don't know all the ins and outs about Glebe, but I've talked to him over the years. I don't have anything personally against Glebe, so I don't know. Glebe did agree with me to go lone wolf with the operation, and if that's what he's going to do, well, then he's got a better idea than Kevin Strom. But if he's just using that as an excuse to slide out from under and retire, well, that's not a good thing either. And Pierce made the same mistake that Classen did. He thought he could get that tax exemption under that Cosmo Theist Church. And I told them both, I said, you're never going to get tax exemption with a racist organization. I don't care what you call it. But again, they didn't listen to me. Whine, whine, cry, cry, bitch, bitch. 14.5, I'll be back with you tomorrow on Tears Day with Stray Dog and see how they're doing in New Jersey.